wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Another Monday morning has rolled around, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. Today, as targeted mass shootings in the U.S. continue to occur at an alarming rate, Jan Hocken interviews sociologist Kathy Farr about the social dynamics of school shootings in a recording from 2015, which is sadly still relevant today. As the well-read read, I will follow their discussion with an excerpt from an essay by Kayla Wee entitled, "The Answer to Anti-Asian Racism is Not More Policing." To begin our show, Bill Resnick interviews Michael Zeller about the necessity of demonstrating overwhelming popular opposition to far-right white supremacist demonstrations and marches, and the importance of decisive defeats at the ballot box of white supremacist political parties. Zeller is a doctoral candidate in political science at Central European University who researches counter-mobilization against far-right demonstrations. But before we begin, I want to let you know that we've just started our spring membership drive. 80% of KBOO's funding comes from listeners like you. KBOO, at 52 years old, is one of the oldest community-powered radio stations in the country, and it is a civic treasure. If you are not already a member, please consider becoming one. Or you can make a donation by going to kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to 44321. We at KBOO appreciate your support. Now, here's Bill Resnick.
Hi, Michael Zeller. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Michael C. Zeller is getting his doctorate at the Central European University, and he's living in Germany. His research concerns the demobilization of far-right demonstration campaigns, particularly the role of counter-mobilization by the left, including very dramatic challenges to them at their events. He's working in the project of the Central European University. It's called Building Resilience Against Violent Extremism and Polarization. Its acronym is BRAVE, BRAVE. Michael Zellner also heads the Organizational Research Unit at the Center for the Analysis of the Radical Right. So Michael Zeller, stopping the anti-democratic extreme right must go on at multiple levels. To stop them and stop their recruiting, the left has to counter-mobilize at their events. And also stop their recruiting in the clubs and in the schools and in colleges and in bars. You also have to deny far-right and neo-Nazis places to hold their talks and meetings. Also challenge them on the internet and social media. And again, through force of numbers, bottle up their demonstrations and marches. And in the process, show public opposition to them and humiliate them, demoralize them. Then there's to stop their infiltration of the police and military. Also very important, we'll be talking about today, soundly defeat their political parties. And finally, the most important, we need to dry up the pool of alienated and angry people that the far right recruits. And to do that, to diminish that pool of angry and alienated people, we have to create a just society for everybody. And creating a just society, it requires living wage jobs for all. It requires dignified participation in national life and also democratically run workplaces. And finally, it requires opportunity for decent lives and being merciful to marginal people and the troubled. Michael Zeller, you've written on counter-mobilizing and demoralizing the far right. You've also studied the far right and how far right political parties can be defeated. First, tell us how the radical right uses demonstrations and rallies. and then how to defeat them. And then finally, we can discuss defeating their political parties. So what are the demonstrations for them? Why do they do it?
Well, you've captured in that broad sweep all the areas in which the far right and the right wing extremists really attack democratic societies. As far as demonstrations are concerned, these are the central tool for many far-right movements and groups across innumerable countries. They use them as ways to project their presence in society, as ways to promote solidarity among their members. And there's a nostalgia element, especially for avowed neo-Nazis, harking back to some glorious interwar fascist regime. And these demonstrations become rituals for the far right quite often, serving both symbolic and instrumental purposes.
In those marches, like in their political parties, they generally, it seems to me, conceal their actual white supremacist and authoritarian ambitions, concealed to popular audiences. We can see them very clearly by attributing the troubles of the working class and the precarious middle class, of which there are in all of these countries, Germany much less than the United States, of course, but still precarious and sort of downwardly mobile people who've been caught in the spiral down that's been created by corporate power as they continuously enrich themselves and gain more power. It seems to be they're addicted to it within our system. They blame the problems of the working class and their lack of recognition and their downward mobility on liberals who coddle immigrants and people of color, that they've lost their country. Trump's rhetoric is very similar, it seems to me, than the rhetoric across Europe. And it's pretty effective, right? Especially in their political parties, but also that their demonstrations don't claim, there's a few who claim to be Nazis and carry the swastika, but a great deal of them in the insurrection in the United States were people who would have voted for Sanders.
This field of far-right activity is complex. And as you say, the extremists are one very visible pocket of it, visible in some ways and underground and concealed in other ways. But you're right to point out that there's a wider area of this sector of activity that has more populist, to a certain extent, more popular rhetoric that includes demonizing various groups. And what gives that sort of rhetoric power is grievance in society, which is pre-existing and quite often tenuously connected to the demonized groups that the far right targets. So as you say, far-right groups may say immigrants are a source of crime. This is a rhetorical point in the United States, across Europe, but that point is very easily verifiable on a crime statistics level, and never is it matched by those figures. It is an imagined grievance that plays on people's pre-existing feelings of insecurity, and it doesn't stand up to scrutiny. Unfortunately, the rest of the political spectrum has too often been ineffective at responding to these weak rhetorical points.
This is Bill Resnick talking to Michael Zeller on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Michael's research writing addresses demobilizing far-right demonstration campaigns, particularly the role of counter-mobilization by the left against the far-right. He's also a researcher at Central European University. Michael Zeller, you've written on counter-mobilizing. We'll go back to the demonstrations. What should be done and with what tactics to humiliate and demoralize them, which I think is the goal of left groups who are counter-mobilizing?
Well, I'd be hesitant with the term humiliate. This may be the goal of some leftist counter-mobilization, to humiliate groups, but part of the rationale for demonstrations is really to send far-right activists together as one through a gauntlet sometimes. Quite often, this is why modern far-right groups send their marches through left-wing neighborhoods, to feel like they've gone through enemy territory and faced it and bonded in that. So attempts to really humiliate them may deter from efforts that try to de-radicalize them and peel off members who are in there because far-right organizers have skillfully picked away at their grievances and drawn them into this extremism. Now, that qualification in hand, I think there is great worth in simply contesting, simply being at the place where the far right intends to exhibit its power with its large numbers or its demonstrations, to prevent marches, rallies, and demonstrations from going forward uncontested sends a counter signal that no, you're not welcome here. This message that you're bringing is intolerable to us, and that has a great impact in itself. And the other thing I should add is that counter-mobilization is important for those and other reasons, but in some instances, it may not be possible to generate the mass counter-mobilization that would send a clear societal signal to the far right. Sometimes it is helpful if state actors step in and play their part in discouraging these extremist or far-right radical displays.
Yeah. In Germany, there are, of course, fairly rigorously enforced laws, although at the margins it's difficult to enforce, that actually forbid glorifying Nazis and also forbid their marches and the rest of it. If the organization is clearly affiliated with the sort of Nazi glorification, in the U.S., we have this free speech business, which is very valuable, but they hide under it. And in fact, they even see themselves as victims of the people who are trying to erode their free speech rights. You know, that's another one of their victimization things, is they can say their thing, but we can't say ours.
Yes, you've highlighted this difference between Germany's so-called militant democracy. The whole regime is designed to prevent another Nazi rise to power. Personally, I'm not sure what legal scholars would say about it, but I think gone are the days in the United States where courts and judges could reasonably differentiate between yelling fire in a crowded theater and large far-right demonstrations menacing the halls of power and communities. I think, if anything, that's a benefit that could come out of the Capitol insurrection this year if it prompts state actors to realize that far-right extremism and terrorism is a real threat, and it's quite often an incitement to violence.
There certainly is some recognition of that, and the major law enforcement agencies of the U.S. are going after some 300 or 400 of those people and some of their, quote, leaders, although they don't appear to be the leaders. They're just sort of the most militant, crazy people. And you have criminal laws that they violate, and they can be enforced. And there's also the Justice Department of the United States that can put terrorist groups on a list where the big federal CIA and the FBI and the rest of them, this enormous apparatus in the United States of surveillance and enforcement, but they can be put on a list and investigated much more carefully than, and the justice system is apparently supporting that, at least up to now. On the other hand, relying on the state to take care of them is something that is inconsistent with our need to build an overwhelming sort of force, an overwhelming cultural program to make Nazism and authoritarianism and also the white supremacist fantasy to delegitimate it.
Yes, I think you're right that the ideal response would be mass social mobilization against this sort of right-wing extremism, this vociferous minority that really aggressively attempts to undermine democracy and open society. Yet sometimes, as I said, that is difficult to maintain. Maintaining a sort of social mobilization like that, at the very least, takes a long train of development and building. And far-right movements and subcultures are resilient. You listed all those areas at the start where the far right is active and needs direct attention to counter it. And it needs all the more attention because it's deeply ingrained in so many points and will always have an appeal.
It seems to me one of the major lessons, though, that we can probably agree on when in counter-mobilizations is we have to avoid fights with the police. The far right now in the United States surrounds itself with police. They march with them. They make jokes with them. They're just white guys. And when they get threatened, at least in Portland, the police respond with quite a bit of violence. You pointed out that often at least the threat of violence does have some good impact. But when the police protect them and begin fighting back against a jeering and sometimes sort of aggressive left that's surrounding them, then the police get into fights with some of the demonstrators, and then the police attack. Without support for constitutional government by the police and military, we're lost.
I think you're quite right. And you sort of highlight two sides of this issue of police and state power supporting far-right mobilization. On the one hand, you have police in a moment at a demonstration feeling threatened by violent counter-mobilization. And that's an issue, but that can be resolved on the side of the counter-mobilization. In a way, that's the easier point to address. The more troubling thing is, as you say, the sympathy in lots of police departments, and not just in the United States, across Europe, this is a cross-national phenomenon. The sympathy of police departments for far-right perspectives and far-right groups, the sympathy of military institutions for the far-right. These problems of entryism and infiltration or mere sympathy from the agents of state force are very serious, I think. It would be ideal to see more actions like the screening that took place for Joe Biden's inauguration, checking which National Guard members had far-right sympathies. That might be important information at an initial vetting stage. Another aspect is just monitoring these sort of developments within departments. To my great exasperation here in Germany, there is an acknowledged problem with far-right sympathies in the army and the police departments. Yet the Interior Ministry and the Interior Minister, Horst Seehofer, has refused to allow even a report studying this problem. And that's absolutely counterproductive to combating this very serious problem.
That was Old Mole Bill Resnick talking to Michael Zeller about how to defeat the extreme neo-fascist right. We'll be back with Mike and Bill for the second part of their interview in a moment. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, listener-supported, community-based radio in Portland, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. The Old Mole is made possible by listeners like you. So I want to remind you that we are now in our spring membership drive. Please consider supporting KBOO, the Old Mole, and all the wonderful programming you hear every day on your community radio station. You can go to kboo.fm/give and donate today, or you can text KBOO to 44321. And thank you to all of our generous listeners out there. Now we return to Bill Resnick and Michael Zeller.
Michael Zellner, in addition to their mobilizing in various ways, the far right mobilizing, the radical right in Europe has set up political parties that compete in national elections. In some countries, they've come close to winning. And everywhere, even when they're not close to winning, like in France, they forced the conservative party in that country, also in the Netherlands, to adopt their anti-immigrant rhetoric. In the U.S., they've succeeded in a different and even more dangerous way, that the far right has become dominant in the existing Republican Party, And that's in a two-party system. They nearly gained power in the last election, except for the few very close states. They could have won a electoral college victory. So the question becomes, with regard to the political parties, how do we stop them?
You've touched on a few important and in some cases discouraging, at least at first blush, issues regarding far-right parties. The first point is about how to confront far-right rhetoric. And there's been a mass failure of other political parties in Europe to reject far-right frames on many issues, most prominently immigration. During the refugee crisis, there was a right-wing rhetorical frame that was centered around immigration is a criminal threat, a security threat, and about insufficient resources, as in we cannot provide for all these people, as well as cultures clashing. They're not compatible with our national culture. On all of these points, several European governing parties or major political parties accepted them on those terms that, oh, well, there's some cultural differences that we have to overcome, or we'll have to spend more to overcome our lack of resources to cover these people. That framing plays into the far right's hands about addressing these issues and gives them credibility and legitimacy. Instead of framing it as a humanitarian crisis, leadership in Germany, for example, said that we don't have the resources. They aped far right points of the AfD and other more extremist far right parties. And in that way, they ensured that the far right Alternative for Germany party won many seats in the 2017 election. This is a problem faced by parties throughout Europe as needing to develop greater skill in rejecting far-right rhetoric and asserting their own. In the United States, you point out the more troubling fact that the Republican Party has been captured by an extremist movement. And in a weird sort of endogenous cycle, the Republican Party generated this movement, nurtured it, and Saturn's children have overthrown the Titan and taken power with the rise of Donald Trump. And as you say, the most worrying thing is, if not for grievances and economic problems created by COVID, Donald Trump probably would have won a second term. When it comes to defeating that tumor that has taken over the Republican Party, I have no good solutions. It seems that there is a committed wing of the Republican Party that's willing to continue fostering this anti-democratic minority or even majority within its party, and that the moderate voices within the Republican Party, if we can call them that, are not enough to overcome this force.
The good news is, however, out of the insurrection, when they looked fairly carefully at many of the people who were arrested and others who were identified, many of them were people who, in fact, saw themselves as defending democracy, because Trump was very skilled in his madness and viciousness to claim that the election was stolen. And he also demonized, of course, all of his enemies as coddling immigrants, the poor, people of color. They're taking over America and exploiting what we and our forebears have built in this country. We want to make America great again. We have to take it over. And it seems to me that if we're going to stop them, there's going to have to be a determined mobilization by people on the left who are not at the elite of the Democratic Party to go out and reach out into rural areas, into the red states, also into the purple states and to the blue states, to talk to people, to sympathize with them, to engage with them, to treat them with respect, and at the same time offer candidates for office and a vision of actually building a democratic state where their contributions are really appreciated.
I think you're right about the diagnosis and the prescription. On the diagnostic side, it's impressive, almost how thoroughly Donald Trump's rhetoric matches up with the stereotypical playbook for populists, nationalists, and right-wing extremists. The demonization of internal and external enemies, the glorious future that's connected to the glorious past that we're going to build again, the messianic side that he's the only one who can solve things. It's just remarkable how thoroughly in line with these central indicators of populist and fascistic rhetoric Donald Trump was during and before his presidency. On the prescriptive side, I think you are correct that the Democratic Party needs to talk more to people who have not voted for them over the last few election cycles. I was really encouraged in the primary campaign when Bernie Sanders had a town hall on Fox News and recalled that the moderator, whoever it was astounded when Bernie Sanders got applause in the building for lots of his responses to questions. I think that captured perfectly the fact that there is what we might think of as the extreme part of the Republican Party that is open to persuasion. There are others who will fall for the demonized term of socialist. Bernie Sanders is a socialist or a democratic socialist, and we can never have socialism in this country, even though we already have light socialism in the United States. I think putting those aside, there is a sizable number of people who are interested in the sort of policies and the humane efforts of Bernie Sanders and the movement he sometimes represents. And that movement, as much as anything, is the best promise for ultimately undermining the grievances that give mobilizing potential to far-right movements.
This is your old mole hour on cable radio. The old mole tries to go to the roots of great issues facing this country, like global warming, like the far-right efforts to take power, to impose their authoritarian white supremacist rule, but of course to retain our current economic system that creates such great inequality and is devastating the natural systems upon which life depends. And we try to show why a better, radically democratic and sustainable world is necessary and possible. Michael Zellner, it was really good talking to you about the role of counter-mobilization by the left against the far right when they hazard their efforts to make great spectacles of their marches and demonstrations, how we can, in fact, turn the tables on them. We discussed how to deal with their above-ground political party efforts, and especially to begin peeling off their support from people at every level, actually, who have drunk the Kool-Aid to some extent, thinking they're protecting democracy. But they can be talked to and reasoned with, some of them. Many of them, in fact, were Bernie Sanders supporters. They were ready to vote for Sanders above Trump. He was very popular amongst those groups. It's going to take the left of this country. The Democratic Party is not going to do it, but some of them will. The Democratic Party combines all sorts of people, some of them the establishment people and corporate people who want to capitalize on the once social democratic programs of the Roosevelt era, that they're still the party of the working class. And on the other side, though, a lot of the grassroots Democrats are ready to, in fact, go out to have those conversations, to form independent groups at the local level, and talk to people who could, in fact, wind up voting for a right-wing party and realize they made a huge mistake, but too late, as did lots of Germans, in fact, in the Nazi period. Michael Zellner, very good talking to you today. Tell us where we can get your articles and sites for that report on examining the far right and how to stop them.
You can find me on Twitter at Michael C. Zellner. My articles are available on Google Scholar just by searching my name. Most of them are open access. And you can find some of my work with the Organization Research Unit by visiting the website for the Center for the Analysis of the Radical Right.
migrant worker. We are the offspring of the concentration camp, sons and daughters of the railroad builder. Chinese waiter, born and raised in the laundry room. We are the offspring of the Japanese gardener who leave their stamp on America. Sing a song for ourselves. What have we got to lose? Sing a
song. That was a clip from the song We Are the Children, released in 1973 by the trio of Nobuko Miyamoto, Chris Iijima, and William Charlie Chin, who are widely regarded as the first group to record under the self-conscious banner of Asian America. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick and Michael Zeller discussing the need for left-inspired counter-protest to demonstrations of white supremacy. If you define a mass shooting as one which claims at least four victims, not counting the shooter, the U.S. has experienced 20, and I'm going to say that number again so there is no mistaking it, 20 mass shootings since 8 people were murdered in Atlanta less than 3 weeks ago. Fortunately, most of the victims were not killed. Due to COVID-related restrictions, I'm recording our show 2 days before it will air, and as I record, I wonder how many shootings will occur before my words go out over the air. We now turn to an interview from our archives. In 2015, Jan Hawkins spoke with sociologist Kathy Farr, who has studied the phenomenon of school shootings. They discussed the gender and social dynamics of mass violence and the limits of that frequently offered solution, mental health therapy. Denise Morris adds her commentary about the ongoing relevance of these issues.
In August 2019, the Los Angeles Times published an op-ed titled, "We Have Studied Every Mass Shooting Since 1966. Here's What We Learned About the Shooters." This op-ed, written by Jillian Peterson and James Densley, appeared a week following 3 mass shootings that resulted in 30 deaths in Gilroy, El Paso, and Dayton, Ohio. The central driver for this decade-spanning study, quote, "We believe that analyzing and understanding data about who commits such massacres can help prevent more lives being lost." For 2 years, Peterson and Densley studied the life histories of mass shooters in the United States. Data from this comprehensive study revealed 4 commonalities among the perpetrators of nearly all mass shootings. From the article, quote, "First, the vast majority of mass shooters in our study experienced early childhood trauma and exposure to violence at a very young age. Second, practically every mass shooter we studied had reached an identifiable crisis point in the weeks or months leading up to the shooting. They often had become angry and despondent because of a specific grievance. Third, most of the shooters had studied the actions of other shooters and sought validation for their motives. And fourth, the shooters all had the means to carry out their plans." This is all from the LA Times in 2019 op-ed, "We Have Studied Every Mass Shooting Since 1966. Here's What We Learned About the Shooters." This is by Jillian Peterson and James Densley, and we'll link to this article on the Old Mole webpage. Today, from the Old Mole Archive, we revisit the 2015 conversation between Jan Hawken and Kathy Farr about mass shootings in schools through a feminist lens and an eye towards changing the culture of masculinity. 7 mass shootings were recorded in 2015, resulting in the deaths of 46 people and 43 injured. Sadly, the conflict over gun laws and the narrative around the role of mental health in these events has not shifted much, highlighted by the ongoing stalemate on these issues following mass shootings in Atlanta and Colorado last month. Now here's Jan Hawken and Kathy Farr.
Welcome to KBOO, Kathy Farr.
Thank you, Jan.
Kathy Farr is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Portland State University. Well, you've been carrying out research for some time now on some of the case histories you've been putting together on school shootings in this country over the last few decades.
My research actually is on rampage school shootings by adolescent boys, middle and high school shooters. I looked at all middle and high school shootings that met my criteria, rampage school shooting, in which shooter went into his school or his former school and randomly opened fire. So I wasn't looking at gang shootings. I wasn't looking at somebody who had a particular beef with one other person. I was looking at somebody who was actually attacking their school. The shootings took place either in the school building, on the school grounds, or in one case at a school event, a dance that was held at a nearby facility. I looked at cases from 1995 up to the present and came up with 29 shootings and 31 shooters. There were two incidents in which there were two shooters. The rest were single individuals. So I really had a subpopulation there. I wasn't coming up with a theory and then looking for a handful of cases that would support my argument or my perspective. And I think where we need to begin in all of this, and it's where I began, is with gender. Because all of these shooters, all of the 31 shooters in my sample were boys. And they were primarily white. And in all but one case were heterosexual, which is certainly a norm of masculinity, particularly among adolescent boys. I looked at not only some of the similar traits of the shooters, but also of the schools and communities in which they lived. My argument, I guess, is primarily that we have to consider gender first and foremost. That means looking at masculinity, in my view, looking at norms of masculinity when we talk about things like mental illness or bullying or a crisis in youth culture. We can't do that so generally. This has to be about boys.
And I think it's always been a challenge for feminists, whether activists or academics, how we understand the troubles of men around violence, whether there's too much ego or too little ego. There's kind of this fragile ego variance of that hypothesis versus the enormous grandiosity and entitlement that's fostered in young men. And I think it's very difficult to garner sympathy for men who are so destructively violent. And yet you're saying we're all kind of implicated in a certain way. And that's one way of thinking about a feminist line of analysis is not just these are horrible, bad boys, but how are we all implicated in some way in this behavior?
There's a whole literature that really provides a lot of evidence that indicates that for boys, adolescence is a particularly difficult time. They are looking for their identity, as are girls as well. But for boys, there are very rigid norms of masculinity and what I have called insider adolescent masculinity, trying to present or perform a masculinity that will be accepted by their peers, particularly by their male peers, because their male peers are really the judges of whether or not they have successfully met these criteria. And during adolescence, this is particularly strong. The norms are much more rigid, it turns out, for boys and for girls. So all boys struggle to some extent with achieving this particular status because their masculine performance really determines their status in high school, whether they're going to be accepted or not.
This has been commented on the performative side of these shootings, that these are not just random acts that come out of an explosive moment of rage, but they're heavily rehearsed, studied, mm-hmm. and imagined. They occupy a place in the masculine imaginary than is acted out by these boys. How do you understand the performative side of it and what's being displayed, particularly in that they usually end up with suicide or knowing that they're going to die on the scene? Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. To begin with, all of these boys have been angry for a long time. And keep in mind, these are young boys. The median age is 15. So they are very young. The youngest was 11. And I did include Adam Lanza, the Newtown shooter, the Sandy Hook shooter as well, although he was 20, because his case is well known, and it was also an act of random violence at and perhaps even against his school. So they've been angry for a long time. Most of them, if you uncover writings in journals, a variety of posts, have been planning or wanting to do a rampage shooting or a bombing or act out against their school in some way. In most cases, they have told peers about it, but that has not been reported. There are so many warning signs. In virtually every case, they had told someone either directly or indirectly. And by indirectly, I mean perhaps a post online or a very violent kind of story. So all of them have severe anger, really rage, I would say. The great majority are also depressed and have been for some time. And some of that depression comes out in symptoms that look more like anger, unable to control their temper, agitated. In my sample, 34% committed suicide, either right at the shooting or shortly after. Kind of the ultimate of the anti-heroic act, murder-suicide, and there's some literature about that as well. Not only the grandiosity of making a public statement, because these are very public acts in a way, their performances as well. But in addition to the 11 boys who committed suicide, along with their rampage shooting at others, some 75% of them had repetitive suicidal behavior. That is, they had multiple periods of suicidal ideation, or they had prior attempts. So these are all long-term, and as was the planning of the event.
I think you're saying there are multiple dynamics to attend to here that facilitate the progress from the movement from a fantasy to an acted out horrible tragedy. But the common wisdom now, I think, among many conservatives and progressives is that we have to have access to mental health services for these boys and young men. Well, but as a clinical psychologist, I can tell you these are not good candidates for counseling and often scare other people. You know, where there's that much hostility, it doesn't lend itself to self-reflection, to seeing someone, keeping appointments, and developing a kind of relationship that allows you to draw on another person to understand what you're so angry about. There is something to be said for counseling, but it's way oversold in this culture. So I wonder if there are other ways of thinking about moving to what we need to do other than just kind of demonizing them, which is, I think, one understandable impulse to just see them as pure evil. But instead, how do we intervene, given that these are scary boys? One reason people don't do anything is they're often scared of them.
Yes, yes. And to the first point, your point about mental health services, a number of these boys had been in some kind of talk therapy. And several of them, their behavior was more consistent with antisocial personality disorder, or what we sometimes just think of as being psychopathic. In a number of cases, they were proud that they had been able to put one over on their therapist. One of the Columbine shooters had been mandated into anger management classes, and he came out of there with his therapist saying that he thought this boy had a lot of promise. He seemed to be smart. He seemed to be somebody who could go on educationally, that kind of thing.
So maybe we need to think about mental health services and support services on a different level than just getting people into counseling.
Yes. You know, like you say, these are very difficult boys. They are very angry. They're not sure exactly what the source of their problem is. Most of them feel very entitled that somehow they were due something. Most of these are white boys, that they were due something that they're not getting, and somebody else is to blame. So there's a lot of external blame placement by them. So it does seem that somehow we need a different kind of support system. At one level, of course, we need to change this culture of violent masculinity, where we see masculinity and admire masculinity that is strong, that resorts to violence if necessary, that
if
will never let anyone take
you don't
care
back
of you,
down
you don't and, back down, yeah. All that kind of thing. And that's really important. And so for the school to take a part in it, that's important. You had mentioned earlier coming up with activities for some boys who are not fitting in so well. And I think that's a very good idea. Some schools, of course, do that. But those activities also have to be valued within the student culture as well.
And that kind of reflection on the broader supports for these fantasies that are sometimes acted out need to be challenged.
Yes, and all of these boys feel marginalized, isolated, left out. But some of them, it's more of a perception than a reality.
This is Jan Hawken and Kathy Farr talking today about these tragic school shootings and what we can learn and how complex it is and what it requires of all of us to change the culture of masculinity.
You just heard Jan Hawken and Kathy Farr from the Old Mole Archive, October 2015. In 2018, Kathy Farr published her research, Adolescent Rampage School Shootings, Responses to Failing Masculinity Performances by Already Troubled Boys. In 2017, I talked with Jan Hawken about how we can better understand the impulses behind right-wing, white supremacist attitudes and violent actions in terms of mental health. The following is a clip from that conversation.
The question of whether a psychiatric diagnosis is a useful way of understanding the situation depends on how it's introduced. On one level, bringing in a psychiatric diagnosis or understanding someone who does terrible things as having mental health issues is a way of arguing against a kind of willful badness. And often mental health interpretations have been associated with a more progressive outlook, that people often do things for reasons not under their own control, and they're driven by tormenting voices. And the point that is often used in the criminal justice system, that people just willfully disobey the governing rules of society, it is a false notion of self-determination. So on the one hand, there is something always important to see people caught in these dramas, even when they do bad things or destructive things or harmful things, as in a way acting out some of their own internal torment. The general psychiatric explanation, if he was psychotic and paranoid, would be it's a way of finding a target, an external target, for the unbearable noise in your own head. And sometimes that is part of a very self-destructive pattern of attacking yourself, stabbing yourself. There are many people who suffer from a psychotic disorder who harm themselves much more than others. But occasionally, you know, sometimes this gets acted out where groups that are identified as the threat become the target. It's also important to recognize, though, that conservatives are very interested in dusting off Manual of Disorders when it suits their purpose. And rather than providing services for people, helping people who are very fragile emotionally and have psyches that are very vulnerable to a lot of noise, and there are many people on the streets who do suffer from feeling like they're falling apart and their lives are falling apart. So rather than help those people, the attribution of a psychiatric disorder or mental health issues often is invoked to individualize the behavior, that this is just one crazy person. But the question is, well, how is the larger society implicated in this madness?
That was Jan Hawken talking about violent actions in terms of mental health in 2017, a year that saw 117 people killed in 11 recorded mass shootings in the U.S., including the deadly attack in Las Vegas. We will link to this interview in the post for today's April 5th program on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Along with being a longtime member of the Old Mole Collective, Jan Hocken is a clinical psychologist, documentarian, and professor emeritus of community and clinical psychology in the Department of Psychology at Portland State University. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was Jan Hocken speaking with Kathy Farr in a 2015 piece from our archives about school shootings with commentary by Denise Morris. A disproportionate share of the victims of violence in this country are people of color, and this past year has been a particularly bad one for Asian Americans. As the Moles well-read read, I'm now going to read from an opinion piece by freelance journalist Kayla Hui entitled, "The Answer to Anti-Asian Racism is Not More Policing." She argues that an emphasis on policing only promotes more violence and drives a further wedge between communities of color. The essay was originally published in the online journal Prism Reports on March 15th. One day later, a 21-year-old white male shot and killed 8 people in Atlanta. 6 of the 8 were Asian women. Here's an edited version of what Kayla Hui has to say. This past year of the pandemic has seen a horrifying uptick in anti-Asian violence and hate crimes in the U.S., many targeting the elderly. Asian people, especially Chinese folks, have been subjected to verbal and physical violence, much of which has been fueled by Trump's anti-Asian rhetoric. Some are calling on more policing as a means for justice. The problem is that more policing rarely results in justice for anyone and only puts Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color, including Asian people, at risk for more violence. Policing is a system deeply rooted in upholding white supremacy and anti-Blackness. The origins of policing have been linked to slave patrols that date back to the 1700s, who chased down runaway slaves and prevented rebellions from occurring. We see the legacy of this policing today in the mass killing of unarmed and innocent Black people, from Trayvon Martin to Eric Garner. Additionally, more policing only catalyzes racial tensions between Asian and Black communities, a racial divide that has persisted in large part due to the model minority myth. The stereotype ahistorically and dangerously portrays Asian people as quote-unquote successful and able to pull themselves up by the bootstraps even in the face of racism and systemic oppression. It's used as a weapon to pit Asian people against Black communities by implying that anti-Blackness and white supremacist systems, like policing, benefit Asian people. This is a lie. Far from protecting us, policing has also harmed and taken the lives of Asian Americans, such as Angelo Quinto, a 30-year-old Filipino-American man who was knelt on and killed by Antioch police, and Fong Li, a 19-year-old Hmong man who was killed in 2006 by the Minneapolis police. Policing is a harmful and inequitable system of justice, and advocating for it would only call for more violence against BIPOC communities. Instead of more policing, we need Asian solidarity with Black and Brown communities as a catalyst for tackling white supremacy and the systems that continuously uphold and enable racism. Dismantling these divides requires unlearning the scarcity mindset, a belief that tells us that there are not enough resources for everyone's needs. In Audre Lorde's Sister Outsider, Lorde highlights, quote, "the false notion that there is only a limited and particular amount of freedom that must be divided up between us. So instead of joining together to fight for more, we quarrel between ourselves for a larger slice of the one pie," end quote. Scarcity mindset underpins the lie that we should fight solely for Asian liberation at the expense of others and ignores an existing history of successful collaboration between Asian Americans and Black and Brown communities. For example, Yuri Kochiyama, a Japanese-American civil rights activist, and Grace Lee Boggs, a Chinese-American social activist, advocated alongside the civil rights and social justice movements for Black liberation, which served as inspiration that was used to advance Asian American liberation. So much of Asian American rights that we see today are in large thanks to Black activists and their fight and struggle for freedom. Sadly, much of this history is erased and ignored, while conflicts between Asian American communities and other BIPOC, particularly Black communities, are amplified to the benefit of the white supremacist systems that oppress us all. Instead of looking to more policing as a solution, we must redirect our grief toward positive healing in the form of solidarity. There is a long history of Asian American communities working in collaboration with Black and other communities of color that offers far richer and more beneficial pathways to justice than more police. And as we've seen time and again, we're stronger and safer when we work together for our mutual liberation. I've been reading from an essay by Kayla Hui, originally published in the online journal Prism. After the show, we will post a link to the entire piece on the Old Mole KBOO webpage. And that concludes our show for today. I want to thank our special guests, Michael Zeller and Kathy Farr, and also Moles Bill Resnick, Denise Morris, and Jan Hocken, and our editor, John Nelson. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I've been your host, your producer, and your well-read red for today. You're not going to hear a perspective like ours over commercial radio, so if you like what you hear, please support KBOO by going to kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to 44321 and donate today. I'm going to leave you today with a brief clip from a recording entitled Unconditional by Bohan Phoenix, a Chinese-American rapper. Get your shot, wear your mask, and stay safe.
我知道人类中学问这个问题，我们的目的在这里是什么，对吧？其实我觉得很简单，就是帮助对方，生活变艰难的时候，去爱对方啊。
George Floyd, Breonna Taylor. You seen the news, go and say the names. 17 years in this country now, seen how the white man played the game. Tried to explain to my relatives back in China, this year's not the same. As people picking on me just because I'm Chinese for the virus, I'm to blame. No, no, we weren't sold here as slaves, murdered and killed every day. The color of our skin wasn't made as a weapon against us. I tried to explain that, yes, we also have been oppressed, but nah, these shouldn't be compared at all.